Welcome back, Left Reckoning patrons. I'm Matt Leck. With me, as always, David Griscom.
How's it going, brother?
It's going well. And with us today, we're happy to be joined by Aaron Thorpe. He's at Paradoomer on Twitter. He's with the Trillbilly Workers Party podcast. He's the comics correspondent for Struggle Session and the proprietor of the Space and Light at spacelightsubstack.com blog, which we're going to be speaking about today, his post from November 28th. Also formerly known as Posadas Trap God on Twitter. I'll say, like, there's certain people that when they disappear from Twitter, their presence is missed. And you were one of those folks. So the sort of resurrection has been well received here in Left Reckoning quarters. So Aaron, thank you and welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. One thing, Ed Bramilla, I forget what podcast he does, but people that, you know, are on, like, Left Twitter will know him. And when I came back, my third account, he was like, "I've missed you more than certain dead relatives." And I was like, God, thank you. That's very high praise. But thank you for having me on, guys. I'm really excited to talk about this piece because just these ideas have been bouncing around in my head for a while. And I really appreciate the platform, especially the work that you guys do allowing me to talk about it. So thank you for having me.
Too kind.
So we have, let's talk about this piece. It's what may have been retroism, nostalgia, and futurelessness. And let me just do the screen share. And yeah, what was your headspace when you were writing this? And like, nostalgia in the past is something, you know, we talk about a lot here. So that it was really, it really stuck with me when I read it.
Yeah. Well, like, I have this obsession with like the 80s and the 90s, you know. I mean, I love streetwear. I love fashion. I love, like, you know, retro Jordans and retro Nikes and stuff. And I was watching two things. I was watching The Last Dance, which is the Michael Jordan documentary about the three-peat that the Bulls had in his kind of last game in the 1998 season. But it's also just about when he first got into the NBA and his trials and tribulations. But it's also a sort of, you know, visual auditory museum, right, of the 80s and the 90s, right? There are a lot of cultural references, and there's just a lot of footage from that time. And I got really, like, you know, I got Jordan mania, man, watching that show. Because I didn't, as I mentioned in the piece, I actually don't watch basketball, right? And I kind of wish that, I was thinking about it why I don't, and I guess it's because you had larger than life legends, right? Like the Bulls, like Michael Jordan, like Dennis Rodman, right? Like Scottie Pippen. And now it kind of feels like there's not that sort of preeminence, right, to sports. I think that NBA ratings even went down after Michael Jordan retired. So there's that aspect. And then I bought this shirt online, which is was supposed to be a vintage Akira shirt from the, I think, 1980, 1986, maybe, I forget, anime film Akira. And I bought the shirt thinking that it was a vintage shirt. I mean, the design on the front, the vinyl graphic is like cracked, right? The shirt almost looks aged. And I'm not going to say how much I paid for that shirt because there is a huge vintage market now, which is booming, especially during COVID, as people don't want to spend more money than they need to on new clothes, right? So I got that shirt delivered. And after doing some legit checking, I was like, man, this shirt's not a vintage shirt. And, you know, I just kind of thought about the socio-political implications. I was like, there is some factory in China that knew that this shirt would be profitable to make it, and they've made thousands, right? I don't even know how many, possibly more. And this is a market. And what is it about sort of borrowing from the past aesthetically, you know, technically, when we talk about art, music, and film? And what does that have to say about living under late capitalism? Why are these reboots and remakes? What is it about this culture of recursion and this kind of budding and growing sense of futurelessness? So, long story short, I basically got really pissed about a shirt that I got scammed for on Depop. I really got into Michael Jordan and decided to write this piece.
Yeah, and I mean, the stuff, the nostalgia that you describe is so seductive. I mean, my hat is a retro Charlotte Hornets hat from like the
90s. I really like
era.
The hat, by the way. I was going to say that. That's a fire hat.
Thank you. And like, I was thinking about, there's like so many examples I could go with. Like, I'm rewatching X-Files in part because, like, I remember when I was like an 8 or 9 year old, like, I guess I didn't remember. I've forgotten how much like the patterns of that show had, you know, I guess set me on a groove of like questioning the government. Cause like that show is fucking wild. Like the JFK narrative they give in it, like it's pretty much like it's a little bit too tailored to cigar man or cigarette smoking man. But like the everything else around it, like isn't a bad starter kit for like giving people the, you know, the works. And they also like they invoke, you know, actual documented horrors of American state, like regular in that show. Anyway, like, and then there's this other thing where the one where I think it's the downsides of it is more clear to me was I got an Android phone and realized you can do these emulators where you can play any fucking game you want. And I download the Pokemon games and I'm fucking flying through like the Elite Eight again, like I'm a fourth grader. And and then I look up and then all of a sudden it's pitch dark out. I haven't turned any lights on because I've just been staring at my phone. And like, what have I done? I've trained a fucking Charizard and like for what? Like, what am I chasing? Right. And like, I don't know. It's just that element of it. I think like, and when you look at why Jeff Bezos is being like, oh yeah, we could just do scripts with algorithms, right? Like, there's something in that for them. And I meant to look this up, but I think it's Zizek in that documentary that's on the Pervert's Guide to Ideology on Netflix. I think he says something like this and that. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but like, if a work of art doesn't like make you want to throw a brick through your boss's window or something, it's kind of a waste of time. And I'm prefacing, but like, that's what I think of. Like, that's what Bezos is getting out of this. Like, attention, they're sapping our attention with this. And we can tell there's something in the past that like maybe, and we can maybe get to this later, that has been hidden or like taken from us. And like, this is sort of like a salve for that.
Absolutely. But I've talked a little
bit too much. You guys can jump in.
No, absolutely. We'll get into it. But like the phrase that I use, hauntology, and a lot of the things that I'll be talking about, like people should read Mark Fisher's book, God, I forget what it's called. I had it. Oh, it's right here. Ghosts of My Life. I use that book as a reference, as well as Grafton Tanner's The Circle of the Snake. I really recommend people get those two books. But the thing about nostalgia that I didn't really mention in the piece in hauntology is that it's about disjointedness, you know?
Yeah.
It's about being kind of out of time, like being uprooted from time, as much as it is about, as you were saying, Matt, alluding to, these sort of lost futures, you know? Like, what could have, I mean, like I titled my piece, What May Have Been. And nostalgia is very insidious because, you know, it can be used as sort of like this this solve for national unity, right? It can kind of placate people and kind of have people remember this kind of rosy, whitewashed past that they want to return to while sort of ignoring the problems of today, or even worse, like a historical concept or kind of perspective where you don't understand how class struggle, right, how these things have built up over time to the point that we're at. And I mean, we'll get to it more, but one thing, this knowledge that we have that we're affecting now is very pervasive is pre-recession nostalgia, which is a coined term by Grafton Tanner, which is nostalgia for this time before 9/11, the 2008 crash, and the digital interconnectedness of Web 2.0. And that's what we're kind of seeing now, right? I mean, this is why we're seeing Fresh Prince reboots and Sex and the City, and now they're fucking doing... You know, and I'm rambling, but this interesting point, though, is the way that hauntology and nostalgia kind of fucked with time, where I know that when the 70s show came out, the 70s were as far away from the 90s as the 90s show will be today from us. You get what I'm saying? Like, those two spans of time are very, but they're not, I mean, it's about the same span of time, but it almost feels like time has been compressed under late capitalism, right? Like, we have access to all this cultural history and time itself is kind of like, I mean, it's always been a commodity under capitalism, but especially now, you know, I just find that interesting, you know, that people who didn't even grow up in a certain generation are nostalgic for a time, like kids, Zoomers now that are into the 80s, you know, it's very interesting.
And, you know, just like, just on that point, there's so many different versions of it and things that people are nostalgic for, but, you know, I just think of like, you know, my hometown of Austin has always sort of had that pining for the past, right? Like even before the recession growing up, like, you know, Austin always had like a very strong vintage scene. People sort of were, you know, a couple decades behind and they liked it that way, you know, in the sense of dress and things like that. You know, and again, I don't think Austin's unique in this, but like there's a big part of it too, at least. And again, this is just pre-recession and it's certainly the case now where it's like a kind of opt out option for people too. Do you get what I mean? Like, it's like,
yeah,
I live an older lifestyle. I'm, you know, this is like early cell phones, but like, I'm not going to have a cell phone. I drive an old truck. I farm, you know, I have a job just to keep the lights on, and I only work 3 days a week kind of thing. Mm. Right. But like, a whole aesthetic is built up around a kind of rejection of, you know, you want to say modern society, but I guess more accurately contemporary society, because it's not like they were going like pre-modern or anything like that.
But you know, they're not like anarchism shit like that.
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, there certainly are characters like that, but I mean, it's interesting to compare that, and not seeing that that wasn't like a market, but now Austin is so overrun, you know, with new folks, and that's all well and good. But like, the collective imagination of that past has changed and become hyper commodified. So going back to like your Akira shirt, right? There are like print shops here that they make shirts that look like they were from the 70s and 80s, and they might be Waylon Jennings or like telling you this or that, but like, that was printed like 2 weeks ago by some guy who's charging $70 for the t-shirt to somebody from California who moved here 3 years ago and is dreaming about the old Austin, right? You know, and like, that's a very interesting part of like the nostalgia and this kind of remembrance too, is like, there's like different, like there's utopian in the sense, and I would say that it is utopian to think you're going to opt out of society, like some of that previous stuff. And then there's like pure market, right? Where you're just like, you're buying an identity, you're buying a kind of, I don't know, cred, you're showing like, oh well, you know, I might not be of it, but like, I get it, right, kind of thing.
Yeah, the past is profitable. You just reminded me of something. I didn't include some piece, but in the Grafton Tanner's book, and I forget the word, but there's a French word for it. There's always a fucking French word for it, right? But it basically translates to sites of memory. All right, so Grafton Tanner is from Georgia, and he covers Stranger Things, the newest season, where I forget where in Georgia it is, but there's a mall that's there that's kind of like dilapidated. And the Stranger Things producers, the movie set, they went to this mall and they renovated it for the show, right? And actually, the renovation lasted beyond the filming of the show because people thought it was going to be a revival, right, of this mall that had become dilapidated. It's sort of the opposite of that season of Stranger Things, where the mall is now introduced as this new site of not just commerce, but where people hang out, as opposed to Main Street, right? So all of these small mom and pop places are closing. And in real life, it was kind of the opposite. It was trying to bring back, right, this site of community for people, and obviously commerce. But I mean, it didn't work, right? Mm-hmm. And there's the fact that it was this physical location, this site of memory for people. I mean, the past is profitable, right? But I think sometimes, though, and for whatever reason, and I mean, people can read the book if they want to know. Grafton Tanner goes into it more. But the mall just didn't come back to life as people had expected it to, right? So even though we can be nostalgic for certain things, right, and try to bring things back, there seem to be some things that are just left in the past, which I find, I don't know where that dichotomy is. As I'm saying this, I'm just thinking of it. So maybe that's another piece I'll expand on. But
even with the mall, right, it's like we can have a nostalgia for the mall, but like, socially, materially, it's a space that we just do not want to utilize. I mean, we're you know, we want to buy our things online, we want to buy them quickly, or if we do, we don't want to have to go inside to a hallway before we can enter the, you know, the store. I mean, hell, I went to the mall recently, and it was very freaky, actually. Like, it was not like a nostalgic experience. It was like, it was the one I had grown up with. You know, this is like, I should have memories there, you know, but instead it's like, this is horrible. I can't see the sun. Like, there's too much commerce around me, you know? So it's interesting to say, like, even though we have like warm memories on some level of like being a teenager and doing these things, like, you know, we really have also like moved past that, as much as I think some people might want to, like, I don't know, reinvoke like the image, they don't want to experience it again.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is maybe random, but I was kind of thinking the way that, you know, even certain films, right? Well, I'm gonna say films, but think about a movie like Scream, right? Or think about like any of these, like, you know, two, like, late 90s, like, you know, mid 90s, like, slasher films, any genre, doesn't matter. I mean, if like the internet and social media had existed, I'm not really sure that a movie like Scream could work, right? Because everybody would be IMing each other and messaging each other and saying, yo, there's some guys going around and killing people, man. And I think it's this kind of person, you know what I mean? So it's like, it's just interesting the way that, like, you know, people are nostalgic for this time before these certain devices, but we can't really take like a modern context and just translate it into the past, right? Obviously, because of all these material, yeah, social, political implications. So again, like, you know, this is again why I wanted to write the piece, because the way that we remember the past and the way that we whitewash it, and the fact that even remembrance is a recreation in and of itself, you know, like that nostalgic, yeah, past doesn't exist for anybody. You know, I mean, mm-hmm, it exists for white men, you know what I mean? It exists for white men, but even so, right? I mean, it exists unilaterally for everybody, depending on racial socioeconomic scale. But for some reason, whether it's Donald Trump or whether it's fucking Joe Biden, right? We have this, politicians are adept at using the past, right, as a national, a signifier of national identity or unity, right?
And it's really trippy to think about, like, let me put on my techno utopiast hat, which is not like, you know, the one I wear, you know, most comfortably, but just for the sake of argument, right? Like, technology has allowed, like I said, the emulator, you can play any game, but you can also like download like the Church Committee report from the 70s and like all the stuff like the government was up to. Like it's a new form of content that is available to folks, that the government is just a fucking liar. And like it was accessible in a way that like it hasn't been before. And I feel like there's like a rush now to, like, there has to be some reaction to that, right? Like, and that's why you see, like, I mean, like the Fred Hampton movie was a huge example of, for that. Like, I think like these sorts of topics, like, and like, just look at the way MLK is understood, right? Like, obviously the Roll Eye stuff is still like galloping every year, but yeah, like the actual corrective to that is probably as visible as it has ever been. Maybe I'm too optimistic about that, but I feel like the internet has allowed a certain leveling of certain things like that. And like, I'm just curious what you guys think about, like, as far as, and then if that leads to something we can, like, our next question is like, what is the role of culture and what do we need from it? I'm curious what you guys think about that, the positive aspect here.
That's really interesting that you brought up the Black Panther film, because when I was looking at like the kind of questions that you had sent, and you're talking about radical nostalgia versus something like The Last Dance, and radical nostalgia, I mentioned at the end of the piece, is, I mean, it's not a panacea, right? But it could be sort of a corrective to this culture of recursion or this culture of repetition, right? Of nostalgia that neoliberal capitalism kind of like is selling us, right? Where radical nostalgia, we remember, you know, resistance movements and working class struggles from yesteryear, right? And I really did like that. I really did like that Fred Hampton movie, because I mean, I understand, right? This is where, like, being a leftist, I got to, like, fucking take my hat off sometimes and just be like, okay, I'm going to watch this, or I wouldn't enjoy anything, right? Mm-hmm. And that movie had issues, right? But at the same time, it was promising that this is a form, like, I mean, a form of radical nostalgia that is, like, being produced, like, by fucking HBO or whatever studio that, like, I mean, people can see. And I'm kind of curious, if the pandemic wasn't a thing, if this film would have, I mean, I know it would have released in theaters, but how well it would have done. Yeah. Right. Like, I kind of thought about that. But it's interesting that these films are becoming, especially since the uprising 2 years ago. Right. Like, these films, there's a market for it, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I like that. But at the same time, you always have to be wary about recuperation in anything that capital kind of takes, any radical or revolutionary kind of, you know, like, moment in history. But I mean, it's a start. Do I wish that it was made by fucking leftists? Yeah, I do. You know, is it a start? Yeah. Are people, and I'll shut up in a minute, but one thing I really want people to check out too is Stuart Hall, who I mentioned him at the end of my piece. He talks about the dialectic of the cultural struggle. So this is this idea that when working class people interface, like, they interface with media, right? Like, nobody just watches something and they're not like a objective, what I say in the piece, an objective repository for ruling class ideas. Like, people interact with the culture, with the media that they see, so they reject things or they assimilate them into their lives, right? And I would hope, and I think, that when people watch a film, like, I don't say normies, I don't use that term disparagingly, but when people who aren't diseased, like, actually that's a better term, when people who aren't diseased like myself, right, watch that film, obviously, right, they're rejecting some things and assimilating with other things. And I think that, I mean, that's what culture is, right? And the role of culture, or what the left should be doing with culture, is seizing on those fissures and tensions, right, between cultural hegemony and between what working class people know the world to be for them, you know?
I mean, first of all, I'll just say, like, in a kind of general sense, because we make this point, it's like people all the time, it's like, you never know what is going to be like the random point or the random thing that changes somebody's perspective. Absolutely. I mean, for example, if I were to be in a political meeting with socialists and we're trying to recruit people, and I saw somebody trying to make a sign that's like, do you like the fire department? You're a socialist, right? I would probably push back a little bit just because not because I think it's like necessarily bad, but it's like, you know, it might be a little confused, et cetera, et cetera. But I'll also tell you that when I was, you know, at Occupy and I was sort of moving from being like a left liberal to a socialist, I saw a sign that said, do you like firefighters and you're a socialist? And it's like, oh shit. And it, you know, it was, you know, like that was a very big moment for me and sort of starting to reorient and at least opening up some space. So again, like, you never know what's going to hit folks. And like, for example, it could be someone like the Fred Hampton film, which I'll admit I have not seen the new one. You know, the worry is like, you always want to make sure that if we're doing anything like that, that it is sort of like a rupture and radical in that sense, in the way that, like, you know, you have to I don't know, if I were in the room, you know, pitching a story like that, say, like, you, if you're telling a story of revolutionaries, you have to find something that is just sort of like radically halting to people in the life that they're living. Like, 'cause that was Fred Hampton's work, right? He wasn't a reformist. He was a radical and revolutionary. What he was saying should stop you in your tracks and say, well, we can't allow the system to continue. But anyway, you know, that's the tension with, like, you know, the space here. But I do agree that, like, we shouldn't just be sitting on the sidelines, either telling people not to see films, because, again, you don't know what is going to be able to break the space open. But I think, like, if we could, because we've gone on for a little bit just to orient everybody, I was sort of hoping if we could talk a little bit about, you know, hauntology, so people know what we're talking about, this kind of disjointedness.
Yeah. Yeah, sure, sure. So I'll admit to people that I have not, still haven't read Spectres of Marx by Derrida, who coined the term hauntology. Man, like, most of what I know about it is from Mark Fisher and the way he uses it to talk about culture under neoliberal capitalism. And what hauntology is that, like, ontology is the, I guess, the knowledge of what could be said to exist, right? So hauntology is that which, I don't want to say doesn't exist, but that which is no longer or has yet to come, right? So I think I mentioned the piece. I think one of the perfect, and also interestingly too, hauntology is almost pronounced similarly to ontology in French. So it's like this really cool, like, double entendre and play on words. But the best example that I can give people, and I use it in the piece, is that, and you just were talking about it, David, right? This progression, right? And I had this similar progression that kind of culminated with Bernie Sanders and his campaign, right? And I mean, as a left liberal, right, I knew that the Democratic Party was, you know, obviously opposed to anything that Sanders, a social democrat, democratic socialist, anything that he was, his whole entire agenda, right? I knew this, but I couldn't really, I mean, you could say, like, simplistically, like, yeah, these are evil people, like, kind of twiddling their thumbs in, like, a smoky back room and they all want us to die, right? But it's much deeper than that. And the best way I guess I can define it is through the example that the Democratic Party is haunted by the New Deal. They're haunted by the civil rights movement. They're haunted by this era when politics was actually pushed by people on the ground, actual organizers, right? Whether we're talking about civil rights activists or whether we're talking about union organizers, right? And the same way that neoliberal capitalism is defined not by what it is, but why it, what it isn't. It's the same way we kind of define a word by its opposite, right? We don't really define a word. I don't know if I'm getting a little bit too heady, but we don't really define words by characteristics of an object. Sure, right? But a dog is a dog because it's not a cat, right? To give a simplistic example. This is the same way that neoliberal capitalism sort of fills this negative space and is haunted not by the specter of communism, not by its apparition, but by its disappearance. Right. This is why we long for these lost futures. You know, people can have arguments about what would have happened if the Soviet Union never collapsed. But at least what I feel like is that there would have been an alternative. Right. We see that during the rise of neoliberalism with which kind of started by, like, Jimmy Carter, but which was sort of weaponized by Reagan and by Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher talks about there is no alternative. Right. So hauntology and capitalist realism, right, are the fact that Mark Fisher, the phrase that he says that there is no alternative to capitalism, right? These things kind of go hand in hand. And for me, I think that the sort of negative space that the Democratic Party or neoliberal politics or the Republicans, our modern state of politics, the kind of negative space that it takes up in the absence of an alternative, whether you want to call that, you know, a European style social democracy or, you know, something like the Soviet Union. I really do think that that is what haunts all of us, you know. And, you know, I don't want to make it sound like everyone is like this closeted communist, right? He's witching for these days of like yesteryear. But there is this very, this kind of bereftness and this lack and this wanting, right? That I think is like reflected in our culture, in our media. And I mean, again, like if that makes sense to people, like that's why I think ontology is just kind of an interesting concept, right? Because it is about this disjointedness. It is about this lost future. So I hope that made sense to anyone listening.
Yeah, and I mean, I would just add that, you know, it's a bit of a dance, and like, I'll just put my cards on the table. I'm like a reformed, you know, critical theory guy. I'm very much like very material these days, but it's nice to be able to flex those muscles from time to time. And I've done Spectres of Marx, and I'll tell you, you don't have to read it. If you want to get anything, it's just like the first chapter is where he really talks about ontology in general, because he tries to write a political treatise just to tell people. It's very funny how it ends. Like, you're like, oh, this is supposed to be like the end of Marxism, and this is like how we deal with this tradition from now on, right? This is the beginning of post-Marxism. And effectively what Derrida ends up saying is like, we need to create a progressive international, right? That is not defined by anything. Because the thing with Derrida, unlike Fisher, is like there's this big fear in all those guys of like anything that's like solid, right? Like if you say like I'm a communist or a Marxist, like they're like, oh no, you can't do that, right?
This is why he's big into deconstruction, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. Like, that's their whole thing. Anyway, so I'm just saying, like, I think, like, as political texts, and the funny thing about ontology of Derrida's work is, like, you can take it and do a million different things with it. So I'm just saying about Derrida is, like, as a political text, I find it can sometimes be more confusing than helpful. But I like reading Derrida even less, not even so much as, like, it's like, oh, he's speaking the truth, but I like the way that he makes you think, right? Mm-hmm. And, like, that text on ontology, and Mark Fisher you know, reworks ontology in his own way too, is why I'm saying this. Like, you know, people just come up with things when they start playing with these ideas. Like, Matt, you would like this because the ontology, I don't know if you've ever read Derrida before, Matt, but it's like very, very, it's like, it's not even dense. It's just like stream of consciousness, right? And he just,
I've read selections, but not from this, but yeah.
And he keeps on quoting Shakespeare like over and over and over and over. And he's like, the time is out of joint. And then we'll like say something for like three sentences and they'll say like, the time is out of joint. And basically like his argument is like where ontology comes is like, yeah, Marxism and communism, the specter has been like removed from the society. And it's always there, as Aaron was saying, in his absence. And he also, I just want to throw in, because it's one of my favorite lines, actually, is that he calls Marxism the only suicidal philosophy, which I've always thought was interesting, because it's the only philosophy that wants to undo its usefulness, right? Because the argument would be that, like, under communism, you wouldn't need Marxism anymore, because Marxism is defined as the kind of opposite of capitalism, right?
Absolutely.
Anyways, some nice kind of radical poetry. But I think that, like, you know, that kind of idea that, like, there is, like, both the material and the immaterial, right? And I think adding that into your analysis, like, with nostalgia is so important. Like, going into all of these things, it's like there is that dialectic and that dance between the actually existing past, the imagined past, and, like, our desire as viewers and people, like, looking at it from today, right? Looking back in time and forward in time at the same time, like, you know, we're putting weight into it, right? So it's like, it's not like a solid thing. It's like this, all of these different forces are affecting like how we remember fucking Michael Jordan, right? Yeah, and how like you absolutely. Who weren't watching it then, and Michael Brooks, who also loved the Michael Jordan documentary, but was not a basketball fan either, was like interacting with it in this like really fascinating, I just think we can, you know, sort of bring it back to the text a little bit, just because, you know, I think that's the tension that is so interesting. And I think instead of just recognizing this, like, I don't know, or thinking about this like English majors, which is very wonderful, and thinking about like, you know, what this means, like thinking about this as like socialists and people who want to do something with it, is like understand like there's a process that's going on. Like, how can we interact with these different forces for, you know, for our own ends?
Absolutely. And, you know, I want to say too that like it really pisses me off when, like, you know, I use the term culture war, right? And it is a culture war, right? But often on the left, you know, you have leftists that use that term disparagingly, as if this is an aesthetic war that doesn't affect like material issues. And I mean, that's bullshit, right? As the Stuart Hall piece that I've referenced, Deconstructing the Popular, He actually like talks about like that culture is a battlefield, right? And like, yeah, like there are many fronts like where culture is like waged, right? It is a war, you know. I mean, there's a reason why, like, you can talk about like, you know, Alex Jones or Joe Rogan and talk about like, you know, these incendiary radio hosts that are perpetuating this culture war. But I mean, there's like a material reason why they're able to do what they do, right? And they are actually out there convincing people, right? And I think that, you know, as leftists, we shouldn't say that, like, yeah, man, this is like all aesthetic and bullshit. And like, when we have the revolution, we'll just start everything over and then we'll put the right ideas into people's heads. Like, that's kind of scary to think about, one. And it's also just, again, like not accepting that people are like these like critically thinking, like, you know, like subjects, right, who interact with the culture that they consume, you know. So I think it's incredibly important as leftists for us to like fight on the front of culture. Now, we'll talk about maybe what that actually means, like what that'll look like. I don't really know, but I have some ideas, you know.
Well, I want to just touch on quickly, like, I think, like we've mentioned, a lot of this is because the future, like, that we have now sucks, right? Like, I mean, compared to like the 50s and 60s, where you can, it's the space age, right? And like, holy crap, we have shit orbiting the Earth for the first time. Now we have Elon Musk, who was like ostensibly the guy that should be doing flying cars, can't even do self-driving cars, and is now like busted, like drilling microchips into monkey brains at University of California, Davis. Like, brutal story, which we'll probably touch on in the future. Like, and that's like the future guy, right? Like, he's basically a future culture war guy. He's squatting that position of like, hey, future comes through me. And the future is apparently like getting a Tesla from one side of a convention center to the other, because we all go to fucking conventions. And let's touch on NFTs too. Like, NFTs seems to me very related to this. Like, that's what they're trying to commodify, is this cultural cachet of something. And you want to get it on the ground floor. And as if like 20 years from now, I'll be like, gosh, remember, like, I could have bought a cyberpunk for $75,000 and now I'd have $7 billion or something like that. Like, we're just that sort of ridiculous like mixture of something's cultural importance with like a commodity to speculate on.
Yeah. The NFT thing, man. And I mean, and I guess by extension, like the metaverse and stuff, man. Like, one of the things that like is really bleak about that is that it really will be this, I can imagine this dystopian future where like the metaverse, you know, this fictitious capital around NFTs and stuff will sort of be used as like these like kind of escape points, right? Escape pods, right? From an incredibly bleak, you know, climate apocalyptic like future, right? Where people can escape into the past, right? Whether it's, you know, I saw an NFT for a fucking original Air Jordan 1, right? Which, I mean, these if you get like the actual physical pair, they're like $20,000 on eBay or some shit like that, right? And you can still wear them, right? But like, you know, I saw Nike's trying to get in the NFT game and like saying, hey, you can own an NFT in of an original 1985 Air Jordan 1. It's not going to cost you $20,000, right? And the way that NFTs, the metaverse, to me, really will be like this, yeah, this escape for people and this kind of like distraction. As you were saying earlier, Matt, like, you know, playing Pokemon on your phone, right, until like nightfall, you know? And I mean, like, dude, I remember when I was a fucking kid and this was before they had the backlight Game Boy, right? So I'm like, you know, I'm like trying to like not turn on my light because I don't want my mom to know that I'm still up, you know what I mean? But I'm still
playing. Yeah.
Like, it's like, I could very well imagine that, you know, the metaverse will be kind of the similar concept, but will our generation will kind of be, I guess, the hamsters for that, right? The hamsters for this like escapism. And I mean, this is a whole other conversation too, but this whole augmented virtual reality thing, we've been talking about this for like decades, right? At least I guess since the 80s, right? 70s or the 80s maybe. And it just seems like the way that we think about technology, and this is maybe another part of nostalgia, right, is that technology has always been seen as this continuity, right, of progression, you know?
Yeah.
But actually, and I talk about this in the piece with futurelessness, there's this idea in this end of continuity, and that could even be technological continuity where, and I just made a tweet about this earlier too, so I'm kind of like ripping off my own self, right? But it's weird that people think futurism as a term necessarily means natural progression. Because it doesn't, right? Like, things can get worse at a higher level of awfulness, you know? I don't think that this technology, you know, under Facebook or Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos will be used to like liberate people. Of course it won't, you know.
Yeah.
It'll be used to kind of like, you know, I mean, not to overuse this word, but like enslave us more than we already are, you know. So that's very troubling for me, the way that the nostalgia industry, their new gimmicks of NFTs and the metaverse, man. It's very troubling.
And even the way that we imagine the future, right? So the opposite of nostalgia, right, is, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, and I hope I'm not stealing this from anybody, but, you know, think about like the couple of the big things in the kind of sci-fi fantasy realm that deal with the future is like zombies, right? Mm-hmm. Walking Dead, which can be really fascinating. I mean, I love early Walking Dead, I have to say. And, you know, and then it's whenever it's the future, it's like a dystopian future, right? And there's budget reasons. I will argue that most of these things are dystopian because it's easier to just film in a field, right? Than it is to like exactly. build a nice exactly. sparkling city. But still, I mean, it's like, it's very dominated by like, oh, we're in the future and the world's fallen apart. I mean, the only one, it's not that it hasn't fallen apart in it either. It's a crisis show. I think of something like The Expanse, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a really great show. I
love that show.
And it's interesting, though, because, you know, Jeff Bezos saved that show from being canceled because he really likes it. And yeah. you can feel the turn in it when he starts to get in, because, like, not to – I won't give anyone any spoilers, but there's Earth, Mars, and the Belt, right? And the Belt are, frankly, radicals because they've been screwed over by this system. And there's a political conflict there, right? And when Bezos comes in, he doesn't – I will say they did not get rid of the political content – but it's almost immaterial, right? It's like instead of it actually being like, we're trying to build a better world and like fight against these things, a kind of like emancipatory kind of socialist thing. It's like we're vengeful and rageful because of what's been done to us. So we just want to destroy, right?
Exactly.
And you can see like why, like, you know, it's dangerous to have Jeff Bezos, you know, controlling like the way that we're imagining the future. I mean, you know, because I don't know. I mean, it's like it's just as interesting, though, because it goes into this kind of futurelessness that like we do have a difficult time, you know, imagining a future without many of the same conflicts essentially that we have today. Right. It's class. Mm-hmm. It's mm-hmm. like resource distribution. And then obviously, you know, Bezos is spending a lot of money to foreclose in our popular imagining any kind of way out of it other than just so we all get punished because some people are doing better than other people. Is that what you really want, right?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. that's interesting that you I don't think people know, and I don't know the name of his professor or mentor, but when he was in college he was really obsessed with like space colonization, you know. And I don't think people like know this or realize this, but like Amazon wasn't like his grand idea, right? Like he wanted to fucking like have space hotels, right? That's what he wanted to do. So it makes a lot of sense, right? That wow. he would love something like The Expanse, right? And I mean, this is the same kind of like, I was listening to this podcast today that was talking about Citations Needed. That was talking about sort of this patriot, this kind of like not colorblind, but this patriotism like that's left and right, right? And this kind of like milquetoast liberalism that you see on both sides of the aisle, right? And liberalism in the political science term, not in the term of like, you know, the Democrats are liberals, right? But everyone's a liberal, right? But this documentary, they were covering this documentary that was talking about, PBS was talking about unions, right? It's a PBS documentary. And all of the material struggle had been kind of sapped out of it, right? Where these coal miners now are talking about these kind of amorphous rights, right? Like freedom of speech and freedom of assembly. And of course, these things are needed and intrinsic in any sort of like union organizing, right? But the same way that Jeff Bezos strips out the materialism out of that show, right? And kind of just makes it like, no, they're just these angry dudes, right? Who just like, you know, they just want basic rights. They want water, like water's life. You know what I mean? Like, they don't actually have any political ideological goal beyond this. Right. So it's like, I don't know if I can tie it back in. Right. But the same way that nostalgia, right, often whitewashes, right, these struggles, you know, whether we're talking about the sanitization of MLK or Malcolm X, which Malcolm X and Fred Hampton, like increasingly as the years go by, like I remember Cory Booker, like he had quoted like made a tweet with quoting Fred Hampton, but he didn't quote the part where he was like, "We're not going to destroy capitalism, yeah. and black capitalism. We're going to do it with socialism." And everybody was like, "Oh, it's interesting that you didn't include that part, man." Exactly. And you know, Matt, like it just like you were mentioning earlier. I just like close this out. You were mentioning earlier that you know, it is hopeful that because of the fact that the internet collapses all of historical and cultural time, right? And we can kind of view all of this from one vantage point. It is kind of promising that people can see that quote from Cory Booker and then be like, hold up, like, let me look this shit up. Like, okay, like, there's a contradiction there, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think, yeah, like, again, with culture, like, that's what we as the left should be doing. We should be kind of, like, exploiting those contradictions, right, in service of, you know, our you know, ideological project.
Yeah. Interesting. You know, I was thinking about the relationship this all has with dystopia. Because, you know, people love like Orwell, 1984, people love that shit. I think like Sorry to Bother You was really great in the sense, like, as like, and we're talking about like praxis and how to create art here. Like, you can't, if you're a worker, you can't unsee something like that. And I think like priming people for distrust of like management and that sort of stuff, like that, that's money, I think, pretty much every time. And like, there, but it is harder to do the opposite. Like, the one example I can think of is there's a book which is basically forgotten now. What's called Looking Backward by a guy named Edward Bellamy. And he was like a utopian socialist in like 1890s. And this book was about how great the future was going to be. And this is like all the, and like, I read it in college. And what it, I like, the only thing I can really remember was like, they were going to have a moving, a sort of canopy system so you could walk down the street during the rain. and people fucking loved this shit. They're like,
oh, some Jetson shit.
And exactly, yeah, like that was their example of Jetsons, and also like piping in music through like pipes and shit like that.
That's super cool, man.
You listen to like the orchestra pipe, and like, and I think like that is like, that's the best version of like, I think if you are trying to create forward looking culture, like, I mean, you look at that, but that's the problem is like, then you get into the other quibbles that leftists have with art like this, which is like, oh, well, you're naturalizing this. You're acting like this is just going to happen in the space of some time. And you're forgetting the, like, the actual like struggle that this is going to take would need to institute, you know, moving canopy of sidewalk umbrellas.
Exactly. But you have to have something to do. Like, you have to have something that you want, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. And I mean, like, I think that the left, you know, in the piece I talk about that radical nostalgia, it can't be enough to just engage in radical nostalgia, right? Because, I mean, then you'll just have like, you know, this kind of exclusive club where people are just sort of remembering of like, you know, these battles of yesteryear, right? Like, we're kind of opining, right? And it leads to, I think it can lead to this mistake where you kind of like don't understand like what, or you forget how difficult things really were. I don't want to say back then, right? Things are difficult now, but I mean, how difficult organizing and these resistance, what it took, right? What the sacrifice that people had to make, right? So just saying that, well, we just need to return to this and just remember this isn't enough because we have new challenges, right, that we have to face. But again, like, this is why I think, like, you know, actually building, like, having the imagination to build a culture. Because, I mean, even the depictions of the future that we see now, if they're not dystopian, I mean, before they were like retrofuturistic, right? So it was just kind of putting a new veneer, right, on we would think the future would, that what would be. And I don't think it's very imaginative. And it's sort of, again, kind of being stuck in this unimaginative kind of culture of recursion, right, where we can't even imagine anything new, right? We have to return to depictions of the past from the past in order to see a way forward, you know? But it doesn't have to be like that.
You know? Or even just like, they're so technologically dependent too. Right. And obviously I want in the future to have nice ass stuff that makes my life easy. Right. But it is interesting. Like, so much pop media is like the world and the social structures are almost exactly the same, but you know, you don't have to cook dinner anymore because it, you know, gets materialized in front of you.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like, would you rather... that's a very sad kind of goal for us to have for society in 500 years from now. It's like, oh, I can get my dinner 2 minutes quicker.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. 20 years from now, do you want like a flying car or do you want a 2-day work week?
Exactly. And that's the thing too, right? Is that like, you know, the Luddites, like people think that the Luddites were like, people will use the term today to be like, oh, I don't want to get on social media or use my phone because I'm not a Luddite. But it's like, no, motherfucker. Like, the Luddites wanted to use technology and wanted to be owned by the workers, by the people who do the fucking work. That's why they were going up in there and like mashing up like the means of production of the fucking capitalist class, right? They were breaking machinery, not because like they were like, oh, these machines are taking our jobs. It's because like we want to have ownership over these machines and the work that we do, right? And I mean, you could totally like, I think like when I imagine like the future, like when I think about it, you know, it's like, dude, like we'll have like vertical farms and shit like that and tons of fucking green space, you know, and like it would be this highly technical, like highly advanced, technologically advanced like society, but that's also like not like kind of this sheen and glisten, right, of like these you know, city skyscapes covered with skyscrapers, you know what I'm saying? Like you can mix like, I mean, eco-futurist, I guess would be the term, you know.
I mean, but skyscrapers are testaments to the office, frankly, right? I wouldn't want to see too many of those.
Exactly.
I mean, that's yeah, like when you look at like the giant infrastructure, like, okay, those of us who don't like religion, it's good that, you know, the largest building in a community is no longer like the church, right? Like it's something, I guess, but like that is just bank towers is not anything. Right? Like it would be something if these were like communal buildings of like the Colosseum or shit like that, right? Like instead of like we're naming our Colosseums again after banks.
Exactly. I want to show y'all something that they're building here that I'm just talking about, like futuristic architecture that scares the shit out of me. You know, so like as we're just seeing more and more people being forced out of their homes here, and just like big outside money coming to Austin, the tech freaks are coming and they're building up. And look, I'm pro growth. I think we need to be building more housing for people. But I'll tell you, as somebody who, you know, was here when there was just like, I could count the amount of skyscrapers on my hand. Like I will say like the skyline scares me a little bit, but what scares me even more is this kind of thing. So this is the Google building that they're building right on the river here. Let me get it right here for y'all. It's not finished yet. So I think this is a pretty accurate rendering. But like that's some pretty dark, like you could see like it's the, you know, the kind of futuristic feel to it. It's definitely a little
some Blade cool, Runner little, shit, man.
But super Blade Runner, and it scares the hell out of me because the number one thing that I see when I drive back, you know, into town is like Google, right? Which is just like, to me, has like no effect. I mean, I guess I use it as a product, but like no effect to me is like the city's history, the culture, the people here, at least people I really care about, frankly. You know, and like, it's worrying to see that like, like that's probably the most like forward thinking building I've seen in a while, right? It does feel very futuristic, but it is a kind of testament to an incredibly unequal society, a rootless society. And I would be very, very happy to tear it down sometime.
Absolutely. Absolutely, man. Jesus, dude. It reminds me of kind of like there's the Mercedes-Benz Stadium in Georgia, and it has this the top opens up like an aperture of a camera. And man, I'm not gonna lie, like, you know, like technologically, like I don't, I'm not an engineer minded person, but it's kind of a cool concept, right? Except it looks like a pimple on the on the skyline of the city, right? It's like fucking disgusting, you know. And it's like, oh, this is like, I mean, dude, it looks like, I don't know, it looks like a fucking prison, like really kind of sort of like a futuristic sort of dome prison when I think about it enough. And it's like, yeah, man, I don't think that the people who are like currently like basically killing us in every single way should be the ones that are the pioneers of the future, right?
Yeah. My trajectory, I mean, I'm a North Dakota boy, so I was big into skylines because I could never see one. Tallest building in Bismarck is the state capitol, so public building, and the tallest one in Grand Forks is the state-owned grain elevator. So North Dakota doesn't have these problems. It hasn't led to like you know, communism, but like, and then now you see like, so I remember like my early internet was like looking at this website called Emporius.com, which is like the internet skyscraper database. And I look at like Dubai and like all this cool shit going up. And then now it's like, that shit sucks. Like it'd be one thing if this was like, if this meant like cheap housing for people, like
what it was for that, people.
Exactly. Then the look of it isn't like that changes my aesthetic experience of that stuff, frankly.
Absolutely. Absolutely, man. Yeah. It's like, yeah, I'm thinking of Dubai, especially, right? It's like, man, that's right out of like Blade Runner 2049 or something like that, man. And I mean, like, I, as a person like who thinks about like the future a lot, man, and as I was saying earlier, like, you know, there's not this guarantee, right, that the future will be this like amazing technological utopia, right? Like, I mean, we know that for a fact, right? I mean, we've been told that like since the Industrial Revolution, right, the wonders of machinery and what it would do for people. But I mean, you know, I'm not going to be the person that says that capitalism hasn't like lifted people out of poverty, X, Y, and Z. Obviously, right, these things are true. But I mean, this technology has really been at, like, you know, the service of, like, you know, the capitalist class, and really has, like, plunged a hell of a lot of people into misery, and increasingly more so, you know.
Yeah, that poverty, I mean, it looks like they could try to keep that level of desperation to keep you serving capitalists, depending on how productive we get. And like you said, like, we had this before the internet. It was, like you said, the machine age, and it was the exact same fucking conversation. What are we going to do with all this plenty? go ahead.
No, I was just going to add, it's like, you know, and it's also just led to such dispossession. I mean, think about, again, like, cultural artifacts, like movies, records, and things like that. Like, people don't own music anymore for the large part. And if you, I mean, I will say I do have, like, records and stuff, but, like, you know, like so many people are completely dependent on Spotify and Apple Music, which, by the way, like, I have no real confidence that those are going to be permanent structures, or at least you're going to have access to those things forever, right? And it's just wild to think that for, like, a lot of people for the past 12 years, it's like they're, you know, they don't really own or have, they only have access to this music by continually having to pay for a subscription. It's never a settled thing. Like, you're sort of permanently a consumer, or you actually have no cultural, you know, products in your home anymore, right? And again, as Matt was saying, like, in this place of plenty, right? That's what's developed. And it hasn't been good for the artists, obviously, either.
So yeah.
We have plenty. Yeah. The artists aren't getting shit. And then we're all sort of sitting here in this moment where everything could disappear in a moment.
Yeah. I just wanted to say, too, you just reminded me of, like, you know, where the past has been commodified, where, like, you know, unless you're paying for a service like, you know, Spotify Music or something, you can't listen to, like, you know, the songs that you grew up on, right? It's pretty insane. It's pretty depressing.
Yeah. And then the seductiveness when you do pay for it. Like, I was going through the Spotify playlist, and you could just turn it in, like, 1986 and listen to all everything that was playing in 1986. That's a very strange feeling in, like, the high fidelity of new headphones, stuff like that. I want to move on to my final question, which is prompted by Station 11, which, to give people a little brief overview, there's a flu pandemic, and society completely crumbles and slowly comes together in sort of, like, tent communities around Lake Michigan in the story. And a whole bunch of the survivors are Shakespearean performers, and they basically go around Lake Michigan performing Shakespeare for years in this post-apocalyptic future. I really like that part. I'm a Shakespeare fan. I think I don't know. I won't get into my iambic pentameter love yet, but I'm curious what you guys would, if society crumbled and they were going to use cultural artifacts to sort of anchor it once again, what would be your preferred cultural artifacts?
David, do you want to go first?
put me on the spot. You know, I will say, you know, Alan Bloom, who's, like, a very conservative thinker, he wrote this essay, right, in the 70s or 80s, like, what's wrong with the American college student? It was, like, the first big, you know, one of the first big, like, kind of crisis, like, these kids are out of control. And he said one of the big problems was that we like, don't read, and we just listen to music. like, there's an over-reliance on music because we're essentially illiterate. I would say, like, if I had to reconstruct some kind of society that felt familiar to me, I would lean more heavily on music, particularly, like, you know, good folk and country, but that's just my preferences. But
you know, like, can I just say first that, like, I really liked that show a lot. I really liked it a lot. Someone who's, like, an apocalyptician, like, I've been obsessed since I was a kid with, like, apocalyptic dystopian media for some reason. I really liked that show because it, you know, there's that Zizek, Frederick Jameson phrase, it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. But in this movie, like, there are no market forces. Like, everything really is, like, fucking done, right? And I really like the way that through community and through art that people are able to eke out, like, this new future. And, I mean, for me, I'm not a fan of Shakespeare, Matt. So when I was not a fan. I mean, I'm just ambivalent, I guess. I had to read it a lot for my literary courses, and I fucking hated it. Some of it I like, though. But I understand why Shakespeare was used as an example, because Shakespeare is, like, even today, timeless, right? It's, like, the perfect kind of vector if you want to talk about art as timeless. For me, though, man, I mean, it would have to be, like, books, but maybe this is a weird one. I mean, all kinds of books, but particularly comic books, man. And the show, right?
Yeah.
Don't want to spoil it for people, but Station 11 is a graphic novel by one of the characters in the show. And I was thinking, I was like, man, these motherfuckers don't have like access to like power anymore, electricity, right? So these kids can't see like the sequential, you know what I mean? They can't see like dynamism in art. Like, how cool would it be, man? Like, just give them a comic book, you know what I'm saying? And of course, like other famous literary works, but no, I'm just talking about comic books here, you know? Seriously, though, that would be kind of fucking cool, you know? I do think that, like, and again, it's David, as you said, music, man. And I mean, that's why the show was like, that's why it was so brilliant, right? Because what else do people do at a time where they can't watch TV, where you can't plug in like a 20-year-old iPhone, right, to, you know, go on YouTube or something like that, you know? People resort to reading and writing and poetry and music and stuff. So, yeah, comic books. That's long story, long answer. Short answer, comic books, man. I'd bring those back.
Well, I'll tell you what the answer will be when Civilization does come
out. Oh, and it will be, yeah.
And I have some bad news for you guys. It's going to be Harry Potter.
It's actually so true. I'm sorry. So you're right. True, dude.
It's been decided long ago.
Like, that's like be 20 only book.
In like 20 years, man, like I joked about it on Twitter, but in 20 years, they're going to fucking, they're going to induct like the MCU into the Library of Congress or some shit, man.
You know what I mean?
Like these will be the things. These will be like the standing, the lasting cultural, you know, monuments, man, for the future.
Yeah, it's gonna be Harry Potter until we can get the generators back up to run the MCU movies, and then those are gonna be like we're gonna build temples around those. It's hard for me to think of what it would be like. My stuff is like you can't do it about Russell Brand radio shows from like 2006 to 2009. That's a little bit too particular. I think. I honestly, like, I'm blanking because the Harry Potter thing is just overwhelming. Like, that's, you don't really have a choice.
Traumatize yourself. Like,
it's already becoming that. It's just a way, like, you see, like, you try to read, and the reason I'm reading the Bible is because I'm trying to read about these fucking old guys in, like, the 17th century, and it's like, all their references are to all that shit. That's the only frame of reference. And you see, like, I mean, that's unironically power of culture, right? Like, the religion is sort of, like, formalized culture. Like the society says this empowers you, and I guess that's why people go crazy about it every few hundred years, like in the Spanish Civil War. Aaron, this is a great conversation. Where should people find your work?
People can find my work at my Substack. I can't even remember my damn URL. I think it's Spacelight. Oh, it's right here. It's open. Sorry. Spacelight.substack.com. Couldn't even remember my own blog. And I'm trying to write a little more. I'm trying to work on this. I like really heady concepts. I'm trying to work on this piece about a necropolitics or a thanatopolitics, basically the politics of death, who gets to live, who gets to die. And that will be on my Substack. The whole pandemic and the whole 180 that liberals have made since over the past couple of years has just kind of been like, I'm losing my mind, like thinking about it. So I want to write about that, and people can check out the Trillbillies, Trillbilly Workers Party. Find me on Twitter at Paradoomer. That's hopefully my last account. Hopefully I will not have to make another one.
You know, who's an expert on necropolitics you should have on is, this woman who wrote Who Must Die in the Rwandan Genocide. That's a Kristen Sinema. You should see about,
Oh God, man! Jesus, dude! I thought you were serious for a minute. She did write,
yeah, man.
Jesus,
she wrote that
thesis or some shit.
Something in the 2000s.
It's amazing.
It's like the thing that I can't quite understand about the state of exception realized. Yeah, so that's like.
Oh, I mean, that's why she's probably the most fascinating character in politics. I have to say,
man. I don't know. That's why I got banned the first time, man. Because I told her to. I said she should. Slip into a natural geothermal formation. So I'll be staying away from Kristen Sinema, man.
All right, folks. Yeah, follow him at Paradoomer. Thanks so much again, Aaron.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. Really appreciate it.